It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, as the season changes, we'll take a look at that perfect fall dish, chili, on our Food Friday segment. But first, some big news on Wall Street today as Twitter revealed their billion-dollar IPO plan.
That's right. Financials of the social media messaging service were announced yesterday, and the potential buyers of Twitter stock are finally able to take a look at some of the details, some of the numbers. Joining us now to discuss the news is Zachary Seward, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, and now senior editor of Quartz, a digital news outlet. Zach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with the basics on this. How closely has this Twitter offering been watched? Who's following it?
Well, it's probably the highest profile IPO, or at least tech IPO, since Facebook. And, you know, part of that has to do with the fact that so many people use these services that when they enter the financial markets, it's just naturally more of interest. It doesn't mean it's larger than other companies going public. It's just going to create a lot more buzz.
And it's not quite as large as Facebook. I heard one analyst call the Facebook offering a disaster, and I don't know if that's true, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on the Facebook offering and how it compares with this and maybe some lessons that the Twitter offering learned from that.
Yeah, I might go for the word debacle.
Okay, that's pretty good.
And that refers specifically to the Facebook IPO itself. Nowadays, Facebook has really recovered. It's trading at record highs. Social media stocks in general are doing very well, and that's part of the reason Twitter has timed its IPO for right about now. But the Facebook IPO went through a lot of hiccups, and I think in retrospect, people say that part of the problem was overheated anticipation of the offering itself. People got really excited. They overvalued Facebook. Facebook itself made some last-minute disclosures that rattled investors. There were problems on the first day of trading. What people close to Twitter's IPO tell me is that if nothing else, they're trying to have the anti-Facebook IPO to do this as quickly and quietly as they can.
And they had some help in that regard, right? There are some federal laws that changed that allowed them to make changes to the offering without disclosing it before now.
That's right. It's called the Jobs Act. It's a little more than a year old, and it's supposed to help so-called emerging growth companies go public or facilitate some of their options. I don't think people would generally think of Twitter, which has now 2,000 employees, as an emerging growth company or a small business, but because it has under $1 billion in annual revenue, it can take advantage of the Jobs Act. That meant it could submit its IPO filing secretly or confidentially to the SEC and get feedback and confidence before making public the document that it did yesterday.
So let's talk a little bit about what we've learned about Twitter since yesterday. One of the things we've learned is about some big gains in revenue that we've been seeing, but they've also got some big expenses on their books, too.
Yeah, exactly. I think the most impressive thing we saw was that in just about 2 years, Twitter went from almost no advertising revenue to a really significant advertising business. And last year, it generated $317 million in revenue. This year, it'll make a significant gain on that, it appears. That said, it lost $79 million last year, and it has, it turns out, never been profitable. And that, of course, raises the age-old question that, about these tech companies, which is why anyone would invest in an unprofitable company. Of course, if you are investing in Twitter, you're making a bet that it has a lot of growth still to go.
Yeah, in fact, I read another analyst who called the Twitter losses a non-issue. And, you know, for us civilians out here, how can that be? How can a company be in business for 6 or 7 years, lose all that money, and still be attractive to investors?
Well, here's the charitable answer, charitable to Twitter.
Okay.
You know, they've focused on making the best experience they can and growing the number of users as fast as they can. And they've been really successful at that. They disclose they have 218 million monthly active users, that is people who use it at least once a month. That's a pretty good number, though, of course, as you said, it's very small compared to Facebook. And those 218 million people who do use it tend to love it and are extremely engaged with the service. So at that, Twitter's been very successful. But yes, if you're making a bet on the company itself, you have to bet that it's going to be able to turn that engagement into actual money. So far, it has been, just not enough money to show a profit.
And one of the things they have to be looking for, as opposed to people who are jumping in trying to make a quick profit and then get out, are those long-term investors, and that's what they're trying to appeal to here. Are they sending the correct message to those types of people that we're going to be around for the long term and that we're a bet that's worth making?
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be, and then any time you're entering the public markets, that's more or less what you're saying. IPOs are a little funny. The day before you start publicly trading is actually when the very first shares are distributed, and those go to insiders, people who are close to the banks that are underwriting the IPO, very wealthy individuals and institutions. They get the stock at the IPO price. It's only until the next day when it starts trading on the actual market, the stock market, that individual investors like you and me get a crack at investing in Twitter. That's what happened with Facebook. You know, people got in at a lower buying price, and then the average investor, for a while at least, seemed to have really been hosed by the deal.
And one of the things we should have mentioned this, but the IPO is a couple weeks away yet. We've got this whole roadshow process that's got to carry itself out. How does that work? What are we be seeing then?
By law, Twitter has to wait 3 weeks from its filing, which was yesterday, before it starts this so-called roadshow. That's when it markets itself to potential large investors, goes around the country, and roadshow is a pretty appropriate term. It holds large meetings at which it goes through the details in this prospectus and tries to make itself look as attractive an investment as possible. That won't take very long, the roadshow, and Twitter's goal here is to start trading as a public company before Thanksgiving.
And I imagine their other goal is not to have any surprises, although there are going to be people looking at these things, and they'll be answering questions as part of this whole process.
Yeah, that's true. They may also have to make amendments to the filing, and that will, of course, be closely watched. Twitter is, you're correct, trying to do this as quietly and with as few bumps as possible, but that, you know, becomes less and less in your control when you enter the public markets, and at this point, anything could happen, including, I mean, we're in the middle of a government shutdown. The SEC has said it will remain open and process IPOs for, quote, a few weeks. That probably will be long enough for Twitter to pull off its IPO, but it's not 100% sure.
You know, another thing we haven't talked about so much is sort of the whole advertising market, what that looks like these days. And there's lots of competition for advertising. Prices there are being stressed. We've seen the income for Twitter going up, but at the same time, there have to be some questions there.
Correct. Twitter disclosed that it generates 85% of its revenue from advertising. So it's pretty much an ad company, just like Facebook, just like Google. And it, as I said, built that ad business in pretty much the last 2 years, which is very impressive. At the same time, it has a ton of competition, and it also disclosed that the rates that it charges for advertising have been declining, and that's a big risk, of course, to its business. The brightest note in the filing, I think, was that Twitter said 65% of its ad revenue comes from mobile devices, people's smartphones, essentially. That's really interesting because it contrasts starkly with Facebook. At the time of its IPO, 0% of Facebook's ad revenue was coming from mobile. And now Twitter is saying 65% of its revenue is mobile. That sort of reflects a broader shift in the web as a whole, and it does seem to suggest that Twitter is well positioned to, you know, maintain its business at the very least as people increasingly use their phones and abandon desktop computers.
All right. Well, Zachary Seward, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. Zachary Seward's been with us talking about the Twitter IPO that we've all been hearing about. And if you're going to be looking for that on the exchange, by the way, their symbol is going to be TWTR. So keep your eyes open for that. Zachary Seward, senior editor of the digital news outlet Quartz.
Coming up next, we'll talk all things chili in our Food Friday segment. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now that the weather is getting colder, and as we just heard in the news, much colder in certain parts of the upper Midwest, hot food is making its way back into the kitchen.
Well, one of the great things to eat when it's chilly outside is chili. So we thought for Food Friday this week, we'd talk to a chili expert.
And we've got a great one. Here to share his chili expertise with us is John Raven. He is a writer for TexasCooking.com. He has a couple of degrees we need to talk about, a PhD, that is a Doctor of Barbecue Philosophy, and a PhC, a Doctor of Chili Philosophy. John Raven, welcome to Central Time. And John Raven is there someplace. He should be here now. John, welcome to Central Time. Are you here now?
Thank you.
There we go. Sorry about that. We had a little confusion with buttons and all of that. I want to start out with your educational background because, as you know, the Central Time audience is highly educated, and titles mean a great deal to us. We've had PhDs here, MDs, BAs, MAs. We've never had a PhB or a PhC before. Tell me a little bit about how you earn those.
Well, the important part of my education we want to get first, which laid the basis for everything else, I am a high school graduate. I graduated from Taylor High School in 1956, and from there, it's just been uphill. The PhB is Doctor of Barbecue Philosophy. That is one of 30 of the degrees or less that's been handed out in the world, and I got one for my work in the development and promotion of barbecue and the barbecue industry. The CHD is for my work in the chili world. That's a Doctor of Chili Philosophy. And I've been hanging around the chili world for 40 years now. So I've stirred a lot of chili in my time.
Well, you wrote that you learned to cook chili in large part through trial and error. What kind of errors did you make that you'd say steer clear of this to people trying to make their own chili?
I'm sorry, repeat that.
What kind of errors would you warn people away from when they're trying to cook their chili?
Oh, the first thing is it takes a while. It's not something you can throw together in 10 minutes. The basic natural chili meat is tough beef, which will need 3 or 4 hours of slow simmering to really get it to perfection. And other errors is not reading the recipe and not really understanding what you're doing. The basis of chili is the dried chili pepper. And I've heard of recipes that didn't include that, so that wouldn't make it chili. The official correct name for the dish we call chili is chili con carne, which is Spanish for chili with meat. And what it is in basically is meat cooked in a sauce made from the meat of the pepper plant.
I want to ask you a question about during the time you've been involved in not just making chili, but judging chili. It seems as though the stature of chili has gone way up. You know, when I was a kid, if we got chili out of a can, that was considered to be a pretty big deal, or my mom's Betty Crocker recipe. But today, it seems as though chili is really an excellent, fine, high-quality food product that everybody talks about, raves about, and tries to perfect. How has chili changed since you've been involved in it?
This goes back to the chili cook-offs. We started having contests to see who could cook the best chili. And that brings out the best recipes. And over the approximately 50 years now that that's been going on, the chili has elevated, and the makers of the commercial chili, they've had to come along with the rest of us to stay in demand, because just the bad old chili they had years ago is not going to make it right now.
So does chili have to be hot and spicy to be good?
It needs to be spicy. The hot part is up to the individual taste. There is a feeling that's going around that chili is supposed to be just as hot with the chili pepper as you can get it, and that is not true. You want it at your comfort zone, and that goes for any recipe. We want the recipe to suit you. We're not out there running a McChili's and trying to save everybody in the world. We want you and your family to be happy with the dish and stay right there.
So what's different when you're cooking chili as opposed to when you are judging in a chili competition? On the one hand, you're trying to make the best product. Then on the other side of things, you're tasting all these different fantastic or maybe not so fantastic chilies. How are those two things different? And what do you look for in a good chili when you are the judge?
We judge chili first by its appearance. Want it to have a nice reddish brown color to it, and we want the consistency. It should not be too thin or too thick. We used to use a little test there where you would see if the spoon would stand up in the bowl of chili. If it did, it was just right on the verge of being too thick, but past being too thin. And don't want pieces of unidentified matter floating around in it.
Now, how about beans? Some people put them in, some people don't. Is it right or wrong to use beans in the chili?
I would say 95% of your chili recipes call for beans. Now, here in Texas, we're different. In Texas chili, there are no beans. You can have beans cooked on the side and served with the chili, but they cannot be cooked together.
Are there any other regional differences like that? I mean, we know Texas is different. That sort of goes without saying. But in other parts of the country, is there something you run into and you say, oh, yeah, that's from the Northeast or something like that?
Well, there are a couple of places that are, shall we say, hotbeds of chili. We've got Cincinnati. They have a big string of chili parlors up there. And what they're serving is not really chili. It's a pasta with a chili sauce on it. But they call it chili, and they're happy with it, so I'm happy for them. And then over in Illinois, we have the double L chili, which is spelt with two L's instead of just one. And it's good chili over there, but they just never did learn how to spell it correct.
Well, we're close to Illinois, so we know all about that.
So the best way I have eaten chili in my life, I'm from the Detroit area of Michigan, and we serve it on hot dogs there. No beans, of course. Coney Island dog, they call it for some reason. Hot dog, chili sauce, onions, and mustard. Is it wrong to put my chili on a hot dog?
No. Great. Let me tell you a little short story here. Back in 1977, we were working to get chili named the official dish of the state of Texas. And we were having a lot of competition from gumbo from down in southeast Texas. And someone on our side stood up and made a speech, and he said, the reason chili needs to be the dish is you can put it on a hot dog, but you can't put gumbo on a hot dog.
Well, oh, my gosh.
Did that happen? Did they make chili the official dish of Texas?
Chili is the official dish of the state of Texas.
Well, that is terrific news. That's good for us to know and good to keep in mind we're in Texas.
We got an awful lot of publicity on it when Lyndon Johnson was in the White House. He had chili suppers out here at the ranch, the Texas White House, and made chili very popular.
All right, John, thank you so much for sharing the chili stories with us. Really appreciate it.
I enjoyed being here. If there's anything you need to know about anything else, Texas style or Southwestern style, you've got my phone number. Just call me up. If I don't have an answer, I'll make one up for you.
We right. like that.
Thanks a lot. That was John Raven. He's a writer for TexasCooking.com, and you can share your favorite chili recipe or tip on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up on Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to our in-house tech expert about why our computers can be so slow and what we can do to make them faster.
I think I need some advice on that in my office computer here. We'll also talk to an infection control expert about news from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that we may soon be living in a post-antibiotic era.
And we'll also be talking about the distillery movement here in Wisconsin.
Tune in to hear that and more. That's all coming up Monday on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up after 4, transportation in Wisconsin. We'll be asking what would make it easier for you to get around in your part of the state.
First, Richard Dawkins joins the show. He's an evolutionary biologist, one of the world's most prominent and outspoken atheists. He's the author of a lot of books, including The Selfish Gene, The God Delusion. His latest is An Appetite for Wonder, The Making of a Scientist. Richard Dawkins, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with that concept of wonder. A lot of people may think back to science class and remember being bored or confused or overwhelmed. Why should we have an appetite for wonder when it comes to the scientific and natural world?
It is a bit of a tragedy that science does seem to put people off. I suppose it's a bit too much of the Bunsen burner and not enough of the Carl Sagans and the cosmos. Science is wonderful because the universe is such a vast place and such an exciting place to be in, and above all, it's so exciting that we understand so much about it now, including the living world, which is my own special interest. So I do think that people who don't get the wonder of science are actually missing out on something very important, very, very beautiful, actually rather poetic.
How did you first discover your own appetite for wonder?
Well, rather late, actually. I don't think I sort of got it until I was at university, rather to my regret, so I kind of missed out on it for much of my childhood. I think it was at Oxford where I was learning about intellectual problems and the deep problems of existence and how science is coming so close to being able to answer them now.
Well, when I heard you were born in Kenya, spent your childhood in Africa, I assumed, oh, well, that makes sense. He saw this wonderful biological, natural diversity, so of course he went into biology. That's not how it worked, it turns out.
Well, I wish it were. I would like to be able to say that an African childhood turned me on to natural history, and it should have done. But although I wasn't exactly turned off, I wasn't exposed to things like rhinos and lions and elephants. And so I can't really claim the obvious inference that Africa turned me on to natural history.
And a point of confusion got you bitten by or stung by a scorpion?
I'm not really proud of that, yes. I thought it was a lizard. I'm ashamed to say. Now, I was only 3, but really there's almost nothing in common between a lizard and a scorpion. So I just put my foot in the way of it. I didn't put it on top of it, only in the way of it. I wanted the lizard, as I thought, to run over my bare foot. And unfortunately, it ran its sting into my bare foot, and I screamed and passed out.
Well, a little less painful. I hope you mentioned your education at Oxford. And I wonder, what was it that worked and engaged you in science there that maybe we could learn from in the way we teach science?
Well, it's a rather expensive education system, the tutorial system, where the undergraduate has once a week an hour-long one-on-one tutorial with a tutor, where he produces an essay which he spent the whole week working on. And working on it means going into the library with a list of references to the original research literature, not textbooks, but the actual research papers, and therefore is in a position to become a kind of world expert on, admittedly, a very narrow subject, the subject of the week's essay. And that's a rather wonderful experience. You're reading sometimes about controversial subjects, and your essay has to be a sort of evaluation, a kind of judgment of coming down on one side, perhaps, or the other side in a controversy that involves real scientists. And so the undergraduate can kind of feel like a real scientist.
I didn't feel that way as an undergraduate very often. Do you think that we're making a mistake in the way we teach sciences and that we just lecture at instead of engaging in?
Well, that is possible. I don't think that the Oxford lectures were anything to write home about. I mean, some of them were okay, but there was nothing special about them. I really do think it was the weekly essay that did it for me.
When did you first encounter the works of Charles Darwin?
Well, I encountered Charles Darwin's ideas at school when I was about 14 or 15, and my father had also previously introduced me to them. But I didn't actually read Charles Darwin himself until I was at Oxford.
And what was when you first started reading and delving in, how did that affect you?
I found reading Darwin to be a rather exhilarating experience. You feel you're ushered into the presence of a great mind. It's almost like going into a presence. You feel he's so clever, so patient, so eager to make his readers understand, anticipating difficulties, anticipating possible arguments. A great experience to read Darwin himself.
What strikes me about Darwin is that about all he had was observation. He didn't have genetics yet. He didn't have a lot of fossils to work with. How did he do so much without all that stuff we take for granted now?
Well, it's a good point. He certainly had no genetics. That's quite true. The genetics of his time was hopelessly wrong, and Darwin was hopelessly wrong with it. He did have fossils, many of which he discovered himself, actually, on his travels in South America when the Beagle was going around the world, HMS Beagle with Captain Fitzroy. Captain Fitzroy put Darwin ashore for quite long periods, and Darwin would trek across country and join the Beagle again at other places. And while on land in South America, he made some very significant discoveries of fossils. So he did have fossils. He did have the evidence of biogeography. He was able to see, as he went around the world, especially on the Galapagos Islands, especially on South America, he was able to see the distribution of species and compare the fauna of islands with neighboring islands, with more distant islands, and with the mainland a bit further away, and was able to see that the distribution of animals and plants was exactly what you would expect if they had evolved. And so this was a very powerful source of evidence for Darwin. So although you're right that he didn't have genetics, he did have quite a lot of other evidence, and he had comparative anatomy, of course.
So we'll check back in on your scientific career and advance that a little bit, but as you write about your childhood and growing up, you keep checking in on your development as an atheist. When did you first get skeptical about religion?
At the age of about 9, I suppose, talking to my mother, I realized that it was an accident of my birth that I happened to be going to Anglican schools, and I could equally well have been in an Islamic country or a Buddhist country or a Hindu country. So there are all these different religions, and they can't all be right, and there's no particular reason to think the one I was brought up in was the right one. So that sort of initiated my skepticism at the age of about 9, but then I rather forgot about that and became reconverted to Christianity when I was confirmed at the age of about 13 into the Anglican Church.
And Elvis kept you faithful for a little longer than you might otherwise have done.
Right,
how did that happen?
Well, I kind of gave up on Christianity soon after getting confirmed, but I kept on with a bit of, well, what you could call deism, a bit of belief in some sort of creative intelligence. That's a bit more than deism, some kind of theism, but not specifically Christian. Because I was so impressed, as a student of biology, I was so impressed with the order, beauty, and so on, and the illusion of design in the living world. And so I sort of felt there had to be a God to create all this beautiful life. And it wasn't until... I was reinforced in that by Elvis, because I saw a record in a record shop, Lee Cry or something like that, that it reinforces my belief. I forget the exact words, but I worshipped Elvis at the time. And so I thought that this was a direct call from heaven. This was my vocation. But Elvis himself, the divine Elvis, was calling me to witness for this creator God. and that I, as a biologist, I was in a very good position to do that. And it took me a couple of months after that to realize that I was wrong. And that was finally when I became an atheist, when I realized that the Darwinian explanation for the order and beauty of life was so satisfying and so powerful that really you didn't, not only did you not need a theistic explanation, but that it was rather undignified and rather empty explanation.
So what is it that makes Darwin's argument of evolution by natural selection such a satisfying argument? I know we could talk for hours about that, but could you, in a nutshell, make that case?
Well, it's satisfying because it manages to take you from primeval simplicity to advanced complexity by slow stages, slow gradual stages. And so it at no point causes you to invoke the sudden springing into action of complexity, which is a nonsense. I mean, that the whole scientific enterprise is to try to explain things. And Darwin's theory is a champion explainer. It really does explain how you can start with simplicity and work up to complexity and the illusion of design by slow, gradual degrees, every step of which is understandable, every step of which is explicable. It really works. It really does the job.
We're talking to evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins about his new memoir, An Appetite for Wonder.
And stick around. We'll be continuing the conversation in just a few minutes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We'll pick up our conversation now with Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, author of a number of books on biology, evolution, and atheism. We're talking mainly about his new memoir, An Appetite for Wonder. Well, Richard, we talked about your development as a scientist and as an atheist earlier on. Do you think that there's a contradiction? Can a person be a scientist and a believer in a faith in Christianity or another religion?
At a trivial level, they can, because many do. Many do manage that feat. I think it's a little bit difficult, actually. I'm slightly mystified by how they manage to do it. I think there is a kind of contradiction between a naturalistic worldview and a supernaturalistic one, which believes in magic, which believes in spells, which is pretty much what it amounts to.
Well, the work that made you a household name, even outside the scientific community, was The Selfish Gene. When you were writing it, did you have a sense that you were going to get such a big response?
Well, I didn't know that. I hoped it would, of course. I mean, I wrote it for a general audience, but also for a professional audience as well. Its response has been curious. It was at first received rather positively, pretty much universally, and then it kind of became controversial a bit later, which is the opposite way around from what you'd expect. I think it is now largely accepted by field biologists who are actually out there working on Serengeti plains or on polar bears in the Arctic, whatever it is. I think there's a general acceptance that what an animal does is for the good of its genes, for the good of the genes that specifically make it do it via the processes of embryonic development.
And this is an argument within the world of evolutionary biology, whether it's the genes we should be talking about or individual organisms, or some people said groups of organisms, communities, species.
Yes.
Is that still a live argument?
Sort of, yes. I mean, there really is a genuine argument over the group versus individual stroke gene. But individual against gene is not really an argument. That's more a semantic thing. Both the individual and the gene are units of selection, but in a different sense. The gene is that which actually is favored or disfavored in the gene pool as the generations go by. So natural selection actually is the differential survival of successful genes as against unsuccessful genes. But the way in which a gene becomes successful is by influencing the development of individual bodies. And lots of genes club together to build a body together, so that a body, an individual body, is a kind of coherent single vehicle for genes. And the fate of any particular gene is very much bound up with the fate of the body, the individual body, in which it rides as a temporary vehicle. So I coined this word vehicle as a different sense in which we can talk about a unit of selection. Both the gene and the individual are units of selection. The gene is the replicator, and the individual is the vehicle.
And what was the controversy there that developed after the initial response to the book? Was it over the group versus individual, or was it? Did it also include evolutionism versus people who didn't buy the idea of evolution?
Well, no. The original controversy that stimulated me to write The Selfish Gene was the one about the group versus the individual. Mm. But that really wasn't controversial in biology afterwards, not for a long time anyway. A kind of new version of group selection has been revived, which is, I think, a bit of a nonsense. The dispute against creationism has never really been an issue over The Selfish Gene. I did write several subsequent books, such as The Blind Watchmaker, and such as Climbing Mount Improbable, which was sort of aimed at that other controversy, the controversy over whether evolution is true at all.
I want to get into that in just a minute, but sticking with The Selfish Gene, you also created the idea of the meme, talking about the way ideas are selectively passed along and live or die in human culture. That's really caught on in the internet age years after The Selfish Gene was published. Why did that idea, why did that meme of the meme catch on so well?
Well, my original intention was not to make a contribution to the study of human culture. My original intention with the meme was just really to de-emphasize the gene as the only replicator. Remember, I just said that genes are replicators. Mm-hmm. But genes are not the only possible replicator. You could imagine anything which is self-replicating, anything which is copying, copied information which is copied with a high degree of accuracy, could serve as the unit of natural selection. And a meme, the unit of unit of cultural inheritance, is a piece of copied information. It's something like a tune or a clothes fashion or an accent for pronouncing a word or something of that sort. It is copied from brain to brain to brain, and therefore can be regarded as a kind of gene-like entity, an entity that works a bit like a gene, but in a very different medium. And I suggested that possibly there could be a form of Darwinian selection at the meme level. And nowadays, with the internet, as you mentioned, memes are rather coming into their own because they now have a very rich ecological environment in which to propagate themselves.
Well, your memoir ends with The Selfish Gene, but if you don't mind, I'd like to ask some questions that'll spoil the sequel a little bit. What led you to go from being an atheist to a proponent of atheism, one of the best known speakers in making the argument for atheism?
Well, I think I've always been a proponent for atheism, but I didn't let it occupy more than a few paragraphs of any of my previous books. And then I wanted to write a complete book about it. I actually originally wanted to do it straight after 9/11, but my literary agent persuaded me that it wouldn't be possible to sell a book of atheism in America at that time. Then 6 years later, after 6 years of George W. Bush, he changed his mind and said, now is the time to write The God Delusion. So that's why I wrote it in 2006.
And do you think that the argument is catching on? You and other atheists have gotten very high profiles, a lot of supporters, a lot of anger from people who disagree with you. Do you think your message is being heard and people are being more open to the idea of atheism?
Yes, I think there's not much doubt of that. Our books have sold extremely well. You're thinking of Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Dan Dennett and people like that. The God Delusion itself has sold more than 2 million copies in English alone and in about 32, I think, other languages on top of that. And the books by my colleagues have sold very well in addition. And it's certainly something which is much more talked about now. The number of people who profess no religion in the United States even, which is by far the most religious country in the Western world, is now more than 20%. That's more than a fifth of the population have no religion. That's a very encouraging figure. And, of course, the number who have no religion in Western Europe is far, far higher.
A critique I've seen from religious people and some atheists, too, of you and some of the other so-called, I guess, new atheists you mentioned is that the arguments are a bit salty. They're a little more controversial or confrontational, I'm sorry, than a lot of people are comfortable with. More flies with honey than vinegar. Do you think it should be soft-pedaled at all?
Well, I think it works. I mean, I think we'd been playing nice for a very long time and it never got us anywhere. And so maybe the time had come to be a little bit more. It's not that confrontational, actually. I mean, the confrontationalism has been exaggerated. It's exaggerated because people are so used to the idea that religion gets a free ride, that you simply don't criticize it. That's become so much the norm, so much the custom, that anybody who criticizes religion, even quite mildly, is heard as though they were confrontational. But actually, we're not all that confrontational. People are sometimes quite surprised when they read The God Delusion and they say, well, is that all? I thought it was going to be an aggressive book, but it's not an aggressive book at all. It's rather a gentle book.
And then along with making that case in The God Delusion, you've been making the case for evolution, the education, the teaching of evolution in the public in books including The Greatest Show on Earth. Do you think that effort is going well, or is there still a lot of pushback?
Well, there is a lot of pushback, and that's rather mysterious. Gallup polls suggest that more than 40% of the American people not only don't believe in evolution, but actually believe the preposterous suggestion that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, or less than 10,000 years old. I mean, that is just so utterly ridiculous that it's hard to imagine how 40% could possibly hold such an absurd view. That suggests a real problem of ignorance. And that's not unique to America. I mean, polls in Britain suggest that I think it's 19% of the British people believe it takes 1 month for the Earth to orbit the Sun. And I think it's 27% of the British people who think that humans coexisted with dinosaurs. So we've got a long way to go in science education in both our countries.
In just our last minute or so, what is there out there in the evolutionary world, the scientific world, that you're excited about nowadays that's filling you with a sense of wonder as you see the research coming in?
Well, I would say the molecular genetics revolution, since Watson and Crick in 1953, it's been increasingly apparent that the whole of genetics is digital. It's a branch of information technology. It's a branch of computer science. It's quaternary rather than binary computer science, but apart from that, it's exactly like computer science. It's digital, it's highly accurate, it's high fidelity information reproduction, and all the principles of information technology apply to it. That's an extremely exciting finding, and it's informing the whole of biology. With hindsight, I think we can say that it pretty much had to be like that. I don't think Darwinian natural selection would have worked if genetics hadn't been digital. But that's an argument it would take too long to expound.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist. His new book is An Appetite for Wonder.
Coming up, getting around in Wisconsin, what do you think would make transportation better in your part of the state? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.